So the NLF was aware of your
of your
1967 letter.
You know, it was a front page New York Times article, and then got reprinted, of course, in Yunzan and Yunzan Guandoy, and you know all of the different papers in the north. And then
that would have sort of taken the CIA onus away.
It helped certainly. Yeah. Certainly not completely away. You know, everybody thinks, well it might be a trick or something.
Yeah, there's the sacrificing for.
Right.
Or
and then
it would be rotated home anyway.
And then you know, later the expose on the tiger cages, which was not an IBS event, but certainly was very closely associated with IBS.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the leadership in the north and most of the leadership of the NLF had been at Gansan prison. You know, where the tiger cages were. Many had been in the tiger cages.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a lot of appreciation for the questioning of the war. And I think Fred Bramfman and I argue this case a lot about Fred's position, I think, is much more that, well, sure, there were a few people that protested, but they were very few.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people who not only weren't protesting, but were, you know, very actively in support of U.S. policy. But I think, and I speak now specifically of the Vietnam team, yeah, there were certainly a lot of people who were really challenging what was going on, and it certainly made it much easier for IBS to go back to Vietnam and now that the war is over and continue work there. And Fred, specifically Fred, and also some other IBS alumni, Jackie Chagnon, for example,
have
made it much easier for IBS to talk with people in Laos, and get reestablished. So, While there's always suspicions, during a wartime, no matter where you are, there's always going to be suspicions and fears, because so much is at stake.
Sure.
If you're an NLF cadre, for example, working in Saigon, and you are working with an American there, and you decide this is someone I can really trust, and you talk to him, and it turns out that you shouldn't have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you'd be killed.
So
there was a lot at stake, and so people were very, very paranoid.
Yeah.
And information would get out. You know, God knows how, but then people would start wondering, well, was it the American that I met?
And even if it wasn't.
Yeah. But I think that that in general, you know, most Vietnamese felt that IBS was there very much to help the poorest Vietnamese, help the most exploited Vietnamese, and really to promote Vietnamese culture, history, culture, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that those feelings, even now, all these years later, Vietnamese come, here to the office to talk with us and thank us for things we did 30 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the returned bottle of Johnny Walker is a pretty good example.
Different, little different.
It's a little different, but nonetheless, sure. It's in the same vein.
Yeah.
Did you, I had heard, I think, that there were even dialogues, either knowingly or just assumed, that some Vietnamese that you were talking with in IBS were in fact NLF folks?
Well, certainly, even at the IBS headquarters,
that's what I'm
one of the, was actually a mechanic, Mr. Ding,
mm-hmm.
had been an NLF soldier,
mm-hmm.
Got malaria and was dying. And to basically get medical attention, became what was called a Chiu Hoi, a returnee.
Returning to the fold.
waved the little yellow slip of paper and
Uh-huh.
was welcomed and got his malaria taken care of. The U.S. government couldn't hire him,
Uh-huh.
and he needed work. And it was actually an AID guy, Neil Jameson, came to me and asked if told me what his background was and asked if we would.
Neil Jameson, is this the fellow who wrote the book Understanding Vietnam?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right.
He was out in Tay Ninh at the time.
Uh-huh.
So anyway. It gave us a direct way of communicating, what our interests were. I mean, certainly I could not say directly to Ding, go tell the NLF that we're not combatants or politically involved, and we are very concerned and we want to help everybody. And I think an example of this is, for example, in the Tet Offensive, we were at the corner of the four corners of Bai Hien, which is right near the Tan Son Nhat Airport. I mean, it's right.
You're talking about the IBS house.
The IBS house, and
with the piggery and
direct,
all.
Directly across from the Arvin paratrooper units and so on. That area was completely controlled by the NLF. And the IVSers were, in the house,
The Arvin paratroopers had abandoned their barracks and such?
Well, I think they were in the foxholes and down, and so on.
Uh-huh.
So that, to Bai Hien, the corner of Bai Hien was completely under the NLF control there.
Uh-huh.
And, we were fine.
Yeah.
And I think, and Ding told me later, years later, that that he had been quite helpful in making sure that none of us were hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't there then.
No, you would have been out of country by that time. But were you actually out of country during
yes,
that
Yes, I was. I was. See, I left Vietnam late September '67.
And shortly after the resignations, then, because
right.
that was on what,
that's
the 19th?
Right. The 19th, 20th, 20th.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we dated it the 20th. That's my birthday, so I
oh.
remember
oh.
feeling this.
Really? September 20th?
Yeah.
Oh.
So
are you a Virgo?
That's right.
Okay. Because I'm the 19th.
Uh huh. We're both late Virgos.
Yeah, late Virgos.
So anyway, then I was out of country from. Late September until around May or April, May or something like that. I came back here and worked with John Summer on writing The Unheard Voices.
Mm-hmm.
So I was actually.
And had your apartment blown up?
No.
Oh,
that was
later. That would have been later. That would have been,
later.
Of course, after
Tiger. After the Tiger cages,
yeah. Okay. So then you went back again to Vietnam? After the Unheard Voices?
Yes, in 68.
Yeah. Once Tet was already over.
After Tet.
Yeah, when it was already over. In time for that May offensive?
Just about that time, yeah.
Okay. Because I've had people say that they were more concerned about that than they were about the Tet offensive.
Hmm.
That seemed to at least come close to the IVS house, and it seemed to be that it was going to hit. And in a kind of wrap-up, of all the people that I've seen, you are probably most affected by IVS.
Well, I had
down to
far
today.
far more years of connection. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, one way or another, almost continuously since '58, so pretty close to 40 years.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
38 years. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because the final sort of question to people was, how has IVS affected your life? And I was thinking about phrasing that and seeing what would happen to your face.
It's hard to know what. My guess is, I went when I went in '58. Part of my plan was to collect data for a PhD,
mm-hmm.
and. To then teach economic development at a college.
Uh-huh.
So it's probably meant that that I would be teaching at this point in my life at a college, teaching economic development and agricultural development, rather than
probably at a land grant college or something of that sort.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. So, you know, and I certainly would not have had the interest in, you know, overseas kinds of, I mean, even after a couple of years, I wouldn't have had the interest that I have now. Wouldn't have the friends in Vietnam and Cambodia and Thailand. So IBS has been very good for me.
Oh, yeah. And more basic than most people. Okay. Well, that's pretty much the run through, although you had more stuff to say than most people. So it did have to go on quite a bit longer. I'm a little sorry for that. But what the heck?
Oh, wait, you turn it off.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
When
goodbye. And today is July 25th. Paul Rodel back with Don Luce again, and finishing up a few points that didn't get around to yesterday because we both had better places to be and took off. And okay, though that's the other stuff from yesterday. Hopefully we will not get very far. I don't think I even put a label on the other side of this tape. That's because that could be the over-optimist in me. But let's see, trying to do this in something of a chronological order, we did get, well, let me back up one thing that you mentioned yesterday. Or made reference to, and that is the 1964 attempt of AID to get you removed from the leadership of, chief of party at that time. And you said, notice how they weren't successful in 1964. What did you do in 1964 to counter that? Or
actually, nothing. And it wasn't until years later that I knew about it all.
Okay.
I may have known about it then. I mean, probably the whoever was director at the time probably talked with me. And it was just one of those many, many memos that were sort of left behind. In this case, that Rex Ottley, who was head of the AID, or then USAM agriculture program in Vietnam, was our contract rep, felt that we were moving into a time when that everyone needed to be on the team, and of course the team was headed by the military, and and he felt that I was too much committed, in his words, too much committed to Vietnam and to IBS to be an effective team member,
of some greater agenda.
Of a military agenda.
Well, and in this case, military.
Yeah, and I never felt that IBS's role there was either military or psychological warfare or making America look good. I always felt that our role there was to help the Vietnamese.
Yeah.
And I was pretty strong on that. And while in one sense AID certainly wanted us to do that, but they also wanted us to do it in such a way that it benefited the U.S. war effort.
Such as helping out friendly villages rather than questionable villages.
Yeah, and also that, you know, that we should be sending back reports to America saying that that those people who were protesting the war should be helping the war effort and to be used as examples of this is what young Americans should be doing.
Yeah.
And it was, again, you know, that certainly at that point in the war, I certainly wasn't trying to be an anti-war activist in Vietnam, but I was trying to be a development and humanitarian concerns specialist.
Yeah, and politically as neutral as possible.
As neutral as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Knowing, of course, that politics are is fraught with danger.
Right.
And even non-action can be political, but...
Right, and knowing that basically we were being used to help the U.S. effort.
Yeah.
And trying to the extent that we could, distinguish ourselves from that effort as being there simply to help people.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a concern for you, or, you know, not necessarily just individual, but especially when chief of party, that the distinction between IBS volunteers and the military, especially intelligence, be as clear as possible in Vietnamese minds? Or was that something that you really couldn't affect one way or the other?
No, it was, it was something we worried about all the time. You know, that we, the largest number of the IBS volunteers were men. We were approximately the same age as the U.S. soldiers.
Yeah. Tad older, perhaps, but not the officers.
Certainly not officers.
Yeah.
No. And certainly from a Vietnamese perspective, you know, 2 or 3 years of age would be pretty hard to discern.
We all look alike.
And we were working, you know, in fairly remote areas in many cases.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we did feel it was very necessary just for our own security, because we didn't have protection as the military did. We didn't carry guns. We weren't in military compounds, and we were living, you know, with Vietnamese. And
you didn't even have little radios like they did in Laos.
So
I knew you'd smile at that.
There was, it was just very, very important to distinguish ourselves for our safety and for what we were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, yeah, for both reasons. Okay. And how would you really do that?
Well, I mean, first of all, in the
in a direct
in the kinds of things that we did.
Mm-hmm.
Being directly associated with Vietnamese schools,
mm-hmm.
with Vietnamese agricultural departments, with not going to the military compounds, not using the military PX, you know, all of those things.
And this was done consistently, pretty much?
There were...
This was a big debate in Laos, and a number of education people said, no, we're going to go to the PX and have a good time
every week. There was a debate in Vietnam. Some people wanted to go to the PX, and probably some people did.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, people stayed away from the PX. I think the U.S., I never tried to get... PX privileges for IBS, because I felt that unless I could get them for all Vietnamese as well as IBSers, then it was not something we should have.
No. Except, of course, for Johnny Walker Black Label.
Yeah, it turns out that later in my stay there, after I left IBS, and even a couple times when I was there, that I used it for bribes to get people out of prison. Mm-hmm. And as I remember it, we had cards that could be used. People just basically didn't use them very much.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, probably some people did.
Not
something we... It wasn't really a debate in IBS Vietnam. It was, I think, more a matter of pride that we were living, you know, the same, to the extent that we could, the same as the Vietnamese.
In a sense that you're almost above the PX?
I hope we weren't quite that haughty. I think that really pushing it in that sense would have made it an issue that was debated.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to see the different sides on it.
Yeah. I can't remember the PX sort of ever being a real a real issue in, mm-hmm. among IVSers in Vietnam. If it was, I was unaware of it.
Yeah. No, I don't.
Or
think
I've
that
forgotten
it
about it. I've forgotten.
No,
about
I don't
it.
Think that you've forgotten about it. From just to tell you, no one from of the Vietnam volunteers has mentioned this.
Yeah.
But many of the Laos people have,
mm-hmm.
because they lived, many of them, at kilometer 6 away from Vientiane, going towards kilometer 9, which was the Don Duc school.
Well, I think
and
the
they
closer,
really lived at it, you know.
Yeah. I think the closer you are to the PX, and which means really the closer you are to the big city or cities,
mm-hmm.
In one sense, the less you would need the PX, and in another sense, the more that people wanted to use the PX.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was also that in the PX you had to use dollars. And we did not give people, in Vietnam anyway, we didn't give people any green dollars.
Mm.
We only gave piastres. So you would have to find a source of dollars. And
probably lose on the exchange,
And
too.
You lose on the exchange, and I think one thing that characterizes IVS people is we're all pretty careful with money. And of course,
well, they weren't given very much, really.
Well,
I mean, they were given more, you know, pretty comfortable by Vietnamese standards, but still,
yeah.
not a heck of a lot.
When I started with IVS, we got $60 U.S. a month, and we got a living allowance in Vietnam.
Oh.
And most of us were able to save the $60 to use either for our trip home.
Mm-hmm.
So we could take an extended trip home, or it would be just saved. Most of us didn't use it, you know, in Vietnam, certainly.
Like
it went up, it went to 75, and maybe even it got up to 90, I'm not sure.
I've read in the newspaper clippings today an $80 figure.
$80, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
It went up, went from 60 to 80.
Whether it went higher than that, I don't know. I haven't done all the photocopying.
So. Yeah,
do you know if the Laos volunteers got paid in dollars or the Lao currency is the kip?
The kip, yeah.
Okay. Well,
kip or real, I'm not sure which.
Yeah, I just wrote a note to myself to find out, because mm-hmm. that would certainly facilitate. Or if, in fact, the American PX facilities at kilometer 6 would accept.
Yeah, I doubt if they would accept the Lao money.
Yeah, I doubt it too, but I'm just thinking of all the possibilities which facilitated IVS Laos volunteers making use of that American connection.
Americans, official Americans, you know, like mm-hmm. AID or military and mm-hmm. so on, always referred to the local currencies as either funny money or as monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't a great deal of respect for either the Vietnamese piastre or dum, whichever you want to call it, or the Lao kip.
Yeah, well, I'm not surprised. We kind of go along with it.
But if
attitudes toward the country as a whole and everything about it.
If you were in IVS and that's all you got, then you had a lot of respect for
yes.
the piastre.
Yeah, your respect skyrocketed. Actually, these last couple of questions I've thrown at you were questions that just have occurred to me right now. Especially the comparison with the Laos. Could be rather interesting. After the signing of the letter to Johnson and your resignation, of course you were no longer officially a member of the organization anymore, but I know that you followed things very, very closely, still communicated with people,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Probably on a daily basis.
Oh, sure.
Your successor as chief of party was Danny Whitfield.
That's right, yeah.
Do you know, or do you assume, or do you believe that he came in with an agenda to staunch the criticisms raised in your letter as much as possible?
I don't know. I know that at the time, Arthur Gardner, who was the IVS executive director here in Washington,
mm-hmm.
Came to Vietnam and to certainly to try to smooth out relations between IBS and the embassy.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Gardner had been the head of USAM, or head of AID, in Vietnam for several years.
Mm-hmm. Had he always been friendly to IBS even before he had visited
us? Yes, he was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And brought a lot of IBSers into AID as on direct hire.
Uh-huh.
I think Danny was considered somebody who was much more a technician and not interested really in terms of certainly not making any waves and
mm-hmm.
not making comments about defoliation and bombing of villages and, you know, that kind of thing.
And prisoners and such.
Right. But I don't think, at the same time, I don't think that he was into pushing, you know, U.S., the U.S. military type objectives either.
I think that would probably be impossible. My concern was that he was trying to use, he was either being used or saw himself as needing to fulfill the role of calming the waters.
Well, I mean, certainly that was something that Mr. Gardner felt that he needed very badly,
mm-hmm.
and something that the U.S. mission in Vietnam felt was needed very badly.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and probably Danny, and I say this in a respectful way towards him, I think he probably was a good choice to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he would do so without going whole hog pro agenda of the American effort.
Yeah. And you know, also he had been, I guess it's called like a, he had been doing a lot of the provincial representative work, you know, in Quan Tri.
Mm-hmm.
He was also married. And so that gave kind of I think the feeling was that that would give sort of an aura of stability to things. I certainly think he was a good choice, no matter from whose perspective you were looking. I think that he sort of
mm-hmm.
quieted things down, and certainly from the perspective of those of us who resigned, that's what we wanted. We didn't at all want IBS to be kicked out of Vietnam. We felt that was one of the few things that was helping Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being part of the war.
And also it would be good training ground for more Americans to go over and get a close look, to come back then to the United States and say, there's something wrong.
I don't think Danny sort of would have gotten involved in that kind of thing. I think that his...
No, but I mean just the IBS experience would get people to
Vietnam. Oh, I see what you mean, yeah.
And they would turn against the war and come back home and continue the...
Yeah, and certainly if you look at the pattern of IBS, IBSers who went in the early years, you
mm-hmm.
know, in the 57, 58, 59, 60, those earlier volunteers tended
such
to
as
be...
yourself.
Well, I mean, there were some exceptions, but basically tended to be more supportive of the U.S. effort
mm-hmm.
than those people who came, you know, in the, I think 64, 65 was a pretty much a turning point, you know, in terms of IBS questioning the war.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I
and the buildup of the United States.
Right, and certainly in my early years there, I was supportive of the U.S. effort, you know, and
mm-hmm.
in many ways I felt we were there to save Vietnam from communism.
Yeah, I mentioned on yesterday's tapes that I do have your letters to Mom. So, well, I didn't know what the Whitfield administration really was all about. And I you know, after a blow-up like your letter, it wouldn't be out of the realm of the human experience to have a period of repression. You know.
It would have been a mistake, I think, for IBS to have gotten somebody
who had been a hatchet man.
Who would come in to sort of say, you know, gung-ho in support of the U.S. effort.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that would have been counterproductive. I think at least IBS was smart enough to know that.
Yeah, yeah. And what about some of the people who became team leaders? Were they also pretty much in the Whitfield mold?
Carly was, you know, continued on.
She continued. I was thinking of
Tom Fox, I believe, was stayed on as sort of the refugee representative for a while. Trying to think of the other people.
Steve Swift was around still.
Steve Swift. I mean, if you look at the people selected, you know, for those second level leadership positions, I think they were mostly people that signed the letter to President Johnson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Steve said he. I don't think he's. I can't remember if Steve did or didn't.
I believe he did.
Okay, he did say that he was concerned about his draft status.
Yeah, the one of the amazing things was that we asked that anybody who had arrived for less, I believe it was less than 6 months, not sign the letter.
Yeah. But we're going to tell you what we're going to do.
Right, so that was number one. Number two was that there were quite a few people who had real concerns about signing it because of their draft status.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But despite both of those things, I mean, there were very few people who didn't sign the letter. And I think that was one of the things that made it effective, was that it wasn't just two or three people being unhappy. It was pretty widespread expression of concern about the bombing, the defoliation, the making of refugees, and the failure of the U.S. government to even try to negotiate a settlement.
Well, one person that I've spoken to here in D.C. Was Richard Jones, and apparently he didn't sign the letter. And he was put in charge up of the I Corps area. Mm-hmm. Had that been Gene Stolpitz's area?
No, Gene was in Second Corps.
Okay.
Don Runk was I Corps.
Okay, yeah. Because I knew that it was one of the people who had left with you. And so here was a case where someone could be appointed to take the place of someone who has resigned.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so there, I don't know who stepped in place of Gene then, in his region, and whether that was a person who had also not signed the letter.
I believe, I may be wrong, I believe that Tom Fox, who did sign the letter, was the guy
in two.
He was either Region 2 or the refugees, specifically on refugees.
Okay, oh wait a minute, no, it might have been Swift. Because he mentioned that he had around Dalat, or down to almost a lot.
Yeah, and that's Region 2.
Okay, all right, well, yeah.
Okay.
All right, well, you know, I was just trying to work that through.
I think just in terms of the basic question you're asking, which is, you know, whether those of us who signed the letter and those of us who resigned to work on ending the war, whether we felt that IBS was unduly sort of trying to put itself back into the good graces of the of the American effort.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of us, without question, felt that that IBS was very careful about that issue and was admirable in the way it proceeded.
Okay. That's a wonderful answer. Let me see. So I better check that off. Nonetheless, the criticisms are bound to continue, simply because the war is continuing. And all of the excesses.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually IBS was terminated.
That's right, yeah, in I believe 71.
Yeah, at least officially, although it might have, did it continue a little bit into 72?
I don't know.
Okay, all right. What do you know of that termination?
Well, I think what happened was that, as I understand it, that I guess Hugh, who was the who replaced Danny Whitfield, made a statement about the elections, and basically said they weren't fair. And it was sort of seen as kind of continuing the from an AID U.S. Mm-hmm. government perspective, the irresponsible
loosisms,
challenges of U.S. policy and
uh-huh,
so on.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, their argument was that you know, IVS should be completely non-political,
uh-huh.
and our argument was that, you know, you're using us politically,
yeah.
and we don't like to be political.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, there was some of each.
Mm-hmm. Was it the South Vietnamese government, though, that delivered the kick out the door?
That I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, in those years, you know, like 70, 71, 72, you know, in that period,
uh-huh.
that question is almost irrelevant.
Yeah.
In that the U.S. Embassy and the government of Vietnam were pretty much the same thing. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, we were trying to run the country, and Till was kind of a figurehead, and we got real angry when he wouldn't do what we wanted him to do, and
mm-hmm.
The embassy would try to get, say, the Vietnamese government to take responsibility for things like this. The case of IVS being asked to leave, I don't know whether it was just that the money was stopped, the Vietnamese government asked IVS to leave, or what it was.
It might have been, of course, a combination, but
I
had just read something that seemed to indicate that if there was something coming from the government, and
mm-hmm.
just your statement that, you know, there really was no difference between the two governments, you know, pretty much addresses that question. Because
mm-hmm.
if the documents kind of appear, then how do we explain them?
Right.
So thank you. In a long-term sense, though, how much did IVS do, looking backward, in a positive way?
You're speaking in terms of IVS objectives?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think in terms of IVS objectives, in Vietnam itself, you'd have to go, you know, like, specific by specific by specific. I mean, you know, in the late 50s, you know, grapes weren't grown
uh-huh.
to any extent, except, you know, maybe experimentally a little bit,
uh-huh.
you know, in the Phan Rang area.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of work on grapes and so on, and it's just a sea of grape trellises now, and
uh-huh.
a major, major crop. Bulbing onions. They couldn't grow bulbing onions in Vietnam because of day length and so on. In
Velasco mentioned that yesterday.
And there are lots of bulbing onions.
Uh-huh.
So there are a lot of those specific crops,
uh-huh.
you know, agricultural
uh-huh.
crops and so on. Avocado, the thing that we worked a lot on. And then
sugar, you know, baby watermelons, maybe
the watermelons, sweet potatoes.
Yeah.
Those are two examples of where there was, I mean, where they were grown, but where we were able to work on improved varieties
mm-hmm.
and so on. The agricultural experiment station, you know, still, you know, there still continues, so pretty much the same experiment stations that we helped to establish. In the schools, I mean, if you talk with Vietnamese educators, most of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at one point, you know, had a, and of course now the high school students that studied with IVSers are now the principals and, you know,
uh-huh.
and that sort of thing. And they talk very fondly about the IVS teacher that was in their high school and, you know, talk about, you know, like what they learned and, you know, the importance of real concern for the students and, you know, lots of things like
yeah.
that.
Did they pay a price between 75 and then the reopening of the country?
For having worked with Americans?
For even having learned English and for having been taught by it.
I don't know. In some cases, I think that people felt that having worked for an American organization made it a lot more difficult for them.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't thinking of somebody who was working, like, in your office. But more the students in the classrooms or the farmers in the fields.
Well, certainly not the students in the classrooms, no.
Uh-huh,
I mean,
okay.
They weren't the ones who chose their teacher or, mm-hmm. you know, that kind of thing. And also I think the major problem was that in some cases, some Vietnamese, you know, when the war was over, wanted to come to the U.S.
Yeah.
The U.S. Embassy has not been very good about accepting, you know, their claims of having worked for, you know, an American organization, you know, as a way of leaving the country and mm-hmm. getting green card status in the United States. So that's certainly been an issue. I have not heard of anyone who
was persecuted.
Was persecuted or had problems because they had worked with IBS.
Mm-hmm, uh-huh.
But I certainly am not saying it didn't happen.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't know of it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. You're.
And I think the other thing is that. I mean the people who became the government in Vietnam, in other words, the NLF and
uh-huh.
North Vietnamese sides, knew about, you know, the IVS protests about.